From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we hit the campaign trail with Robert Altman, the director of the HBO political satire Tanner 88. Altman also directed the films MASH, Nashville, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Also today, I speak with British writer William Boyd. His new novel is about a monomaniacal filmmaker. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles the Funkadelics, the band that was half Motown, half acid rock. And book critic John Leonard reviews a remembrance of the 1960s by Jeffrey O'Brien. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is film director Robert Altman. He had his first hit in 1970 with the film MASH. The spontaneity and risk-taking MASH was praised for became Altman's trademarks in his subsequent films, such as McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Nashville, and Three Women. Altman's recent films have bombed at the box office, but now he's having success on TV and cable. He directed the remake of The Caine Mutiny, which was recently broadcast on network TV. And for HBO, he's directing the Tanner 88 series, written by Gary Trudeau, the creator of Doonesbury. Tanner 88 stars Michael Murphy as a former congressman named Jack Tanner, who is a late entry into the Democratic presidential primaries. Tanner 88 is shot documentary style on the campaign trail. In fact, Murphy has run into a couple of the real candidates who have ended up doing cameos on the series. Several other politicians and advisors have played themselves in episodes of Tanner. Altman describes this comedy as a chance to show through fiction the inner workings of a political campaign and how dependent the candidates have become on campaign directors and media directors. In the opening scene of the series, Jack Tanner was interviewed on a New Hampshire TV program before a studio audience.
Who is Jack Tanner, and where did he come from? Good morning, Mr. Tanner.
Good morning, Jack. Nice to meet you.
Where did you come from?
East Lansing, Michigan. And Warm Springs, Georgia.
San Antonio, Texas. And how about Walla Walla, Washington? Riverside, California. And Pearl Harbor? Well, let's not forget Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. You know, I was born in Pearl Harbor.
You know, I have to say, Jack, you sound like George Bush a little bit, the vice president. It's hard to know what state he's from.
Well, that's true. But I actually lived in all these states. I was an Air Force dependent. And as you know, when you're an Air Force dependent, you move around a lot.
Robert Altman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much. I'm fresh air I need.
It seems that in a lot of your work, you've wanted to incorporate some of the unpredictability of life into your films. Now, following a fictional candidate down a real campaign trail seems like a perfect way of doing that.
It's the most fun I've ever had in anything I've done. It's the closest to the kind of things I've been edging up to or trying to get people to do, because we're really dealing with a sense of truth, not facts, but truth.
Well, politics has become such a media event. You're traveling with Michael Murphy as Tanner down the campaign trail with, of course, a complete media setup because everything you're doing has to be shot. Is your media setup much different than the ones that are following all the real candidates?
Yeah, we're a little more sophisticated than that, and we it's closer to you know, our lighting's a little more, our scheduling is rather exact. What we do is that we create an event, and we in an arena, and then we have prepared, and then we just document that event. Sometimes we're in a real situation where Tanner and his campaign, the other actors, are dealing, crossing through with an existing situation, and we don't really know what's going to happen, what the text is going to be. It's a lot of found art, and then a lot of it are very structured scenes that Gary Trudeau writes. I mean, they're written. The scripts are, I would say, two-thirds scripted and two-thirds found art.
That's four-thirds, but we'll let you get away with that because you're Robert Altman. I'm interested in the third or the two-thirds that's found art. What are some of the most interesting parts of the found art that have happened?
Well, for instance, when we first started and we were in New Hampshire, we would just hear that Bob Dole was someplace or Jack Kemp was in some area, and we would just take our camera crew and Tanner and his daughter, or Michael Murphy and Cynthia Nixon, or whoever happened, whatever actors we had there, and we would just go and encounter them. We didn't surprise them. We would talk to their, their advisors and campaign people on the streets, and we would just say, be sure that Dole knows his name is Jack Tanner, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and whack, they'd go up and shake hands and talk. That's why we started with that. Then the culmination of that was the show in Washington, the second show we did in Washington, where Bruce Babbitt shows up, and he and Tanner take a walk by the tidal basin, and there's about a 7-8 minute conversation between the two of them. And
I just happened to have a clip of that standing by, of that conversation between Babbitt and Michael Murphy, and I thought I'd play an excerpt of that and then find out what it was like to direct Bruce Babbitt playing himself. Well, but this is, let's listen to the some of the scene first. And this is Bruce Babbitt offering his advice to the fictional Jack Tanner, who's running for president.
So you got a chance now. People know you.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a chance now to take the next step, to say, okay, I'm going to take some risks. Talk honestly. Try to make it work. Now, it may not. I mean, God knows I'm living testament to that. I mean, you can walk out there, look people in the eye and say, okay, I'm going to talk to you straight about our future and how it is Americans have to get together and start solving problems rather than living in this kind of, you know, silver screen stage of unreality.
Was that written for Babbitt, or did he make that up himself?
No, he was. When we first talked to Governor Babbitt, we told him what we wanted to do, and he had seen other shows, and we showed him all the previous shows, and he talked to people we dealt with, and everybody feels very comfortable with us, apparently. So then he said, okay, he'd do it. Then they called, his people called back and said, what are you wanting to talk about? And I said, I don't care. I don't have the slightest interest. I have interest in what he talks about, but I have not the slightest interest in guiding that in any way. So I just refused to deal with that. I said, you can talk about Russia, you can talk about Reagan, you can talk about the press, you can talk about anything. And so that was entirely his conversation with Tanner.
Did you give him any directions?
No.
So it's not hard to direct someone to be themselves. You just tell them to be
themselves.
Well,
they were just out there walking, and, uh-huh. and we were wheeling ourselves along in front of them with a camera.
Now, one of the scenes in Tanner was shot outside of the South African embassy, where there are constant ongoing demonstrations against apartheid. Were those real demonstrators out there when you shot that scene?
The first demonstration, there was a large demonstration on sometime in April, and we went down there with Michael Murphy, Jack Tanner, and Cynthia Nixon, and one of our Secret Service men, and one of our reporters, and we hired a crew, a news crew down there, and we shot them. In that actual South African demonstration where people got arrested, et cetera. And Lowell Weicker was there, Senator Weicker, and all of the people, and there were speeches, and we filmed that. And then when we went back to Washington to do our show about 2 weeks later, we went back to the same locale, the exact same place. We set up our own demonstration. We got the signs and the material from the people who had staged the first one, and we restaged it with a smaller crowd and shot just tighter, and we integrated that film back and forth. But it's hard to tell which was the real and which was not, because it doesn't make any difference.
Are there details that you wanted to get in to Tanner 88 to make it look as real, as lifelike as possible?
Well, I think it's the opposite. We want that, of course. That's what everybody achieves, is to fool the viewer so they think, is this real, isn't this real? But on the other hand, I think it's very important that we constantly let people know, not fool people, that we let them know that this is staged or scripted or it's a combination, and I think it's very important that we keep that combination. We have people, a lot of our own people will staff will say, oh, we think Tanner should do this and what this kind of politics. I don't care what his politics are. I'm not trying to express my own political feelings. What I'm trying to do, what Gary Trudeau and I are trying to do, is to use Tanner as a cipher of, to show people what, if he goes through this, and this seems real, probably the other candidates too. So we're not trying to put up what we think is a perfect candidate. I mean, we make a fool out of, or he makes a fool out of himself, I should say, every episode. He slips or falls or makes some mistake. And we're not interested. We don't want to get him elected.
Nevertheless, do you feel like you're actually with a candidate who's running for office?
Or, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because because Michael says, I don't want to say that. That makes me sound stupid. And I said, well, then say something that doesn't make you sound stupid. And, of course, he can't think of anything.
That's the most lifelike part for
a
politician.
Yeah, so he's exactly, you know, because these guys, they can't talk about these issues on the total sides of them. They have to talk about it in capsule form that fits this media. This is a very leisurely media, this radio. This is kind of fun.
So you can become a campaign manager when all this is
over. That's
exact.
That, well, no, I won't do that. But that's the role that I suppose that I come the closest to. We go to Detroit, actually tomorrow people start going, and we shoot in Michigan the next episodes. And we go up there and we have our script, and we know what we're going to do within the personal complications and plots within our, you know, our staff and Tanner. But we don't know what we're going to find up there in terms of what is actually going on currently in this political race until we get there.
My guest is film director Robert Altman, and he directs the Tanner 88 series on HBO. He also directed the recent television remake of The Caine Mutiny, and his movies include MASH, Nashville, Three Women, The Long Goodbye, and Fool for Love. Now, the Caine Mutiny remake that you just did was for television. It's interesting, you know, Tanner's for TV, Caine Mutiny was for TV. You started your career in television before you even got into movies, and you left that, and I think you were really glad that you did. You directed Combat, Bonanza, The Roaring Twenties, Suspense Theater. I've read that you used to get fired a lot when you were working in television.
Well, everybody,
did you break a lot of the rules?
Well, I broke a lot of their rules, I guess. I don't know. I got replaced a lot, I think.
That's the word for it, huh?
Yeah. Or terminated. But at television, when I started in the 60s and the late 50s, everybody was trying to get into the feature film business because that was the class, that was the quality. And television was a stepping stone. And although I spent a lot, I did many, many, many hours of television. And then when I got into features, it's a matter of allocating your time. I just didn't do any television for a while. But now I think it's more interesting, especially with cable. Most of these things that you're talking about, the Tanner, of course, is on cable.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have censorship restrictions. We don't have, I don't have to worry about having a show on every half hour, every week. I don't have to worry that the half hour has commercial breaks and where they come. There are no commercial breaks. The show is roughly a half hour. Sometimes it's 28 minutes. Sometimes it's 31 minutes. They don't care. So it's about every 2 weeks that we go on the air. So it's very leisurely. And, of course, ultimately, I think the biggest market for this will be, for Tanner, will be in the cassette market.
Mm-hmm. When you started doing television, what were some of the things that you used to do that would get you into trouble?
Well, I'd have actors talk at the same time. And
like in real life?
Yeah, and we would just, there were lots of restrictions, and people had ideas that I didn't get fired all that much. I was kind of successful, as a matter of fact, in television.
One of your, well, I think your first really big hit was MASH. Now, from what I understand, 14 directors turned it down, and then you accepted. Is that right?
Well, I suppose that's right. There were, you know, it was a cheap little script, and nobody thought very much of it. And, you know, none of the serious big-money directors wanted to do it. And I read Ring Lardner's script, screenplay. I read the book also. There was a little novel, which was just terrible. But the script had something in it that was very interesting to me, and I agreed to do it.
What was it that was so interesting?
It had to do with the truth about the Vietnam War, or about an Asian war, as I should say, and of what goes on and the attitudes and. You know, it's not a, wasn't about heroes and winning and killing the enemy. It was about, you know, the only gunshot in it was at the halftime in a football game, and yet we made these operations and the pain and really real, and for every laugh, and it was outrageous. By that I mean nothing was sacred. The cheaper, the more base the joke was, the better. But for every laugh the audience had, they had to pay a little bit for it.
Pay with?
Well, with. Ooh, wait a minute. There's somebody really being damaged out there. There's somebody mm-hmm. really being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not to be continued. It was a film that. That in the end said, this is just a movie, the real thing is worse than that. And it became a series after that, which I had nothing to do with, and I didn't approve and don't approve of that series, because that was strictly, it's a commercial venture, and what it did is, for 12 years, it said there's an Asian war in your living room every night, and no matter what platitudes they said in those scripts, or little niceties, it still said that they were the bad guys and we're the good guys, and I just think it was a very bad propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it wasn't what we had in mind, and wasn't what the film was about.
Okay. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work as a director, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is director Robert Altman, who's done many movies, including MASH and Nashville, The Long Goodbye, Fool for Love. He's directing the Tanner 88 series on HBO, and also just directed for network television the remake of The Caine Mutiny. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director Robert Altman is my guest. Your early films gave you the reputation, films like MASH and Nashville, of being a director who likes to have the actors improvise a lot while the film is being shot. Do you think of yourself as that kind of director who goes after improvisation?
Well, we go after the illusion of improvisation or the illusion of truth. these things are always rehearsed. Any improvisation that's done on any of the projects I've ever been involved with, whether it's theater or film or television, it's always in the rehearsal stage, and we arrive at something. It's very much the way that we're doing the Tanner things now. I mean, the improvisation is necessary because I'm not going to sit there and have a script for people like Bruce Babbitt or real people. So that is true improvisation for the actors.
Why do you like that? Why are you interested in that?
Well, I just think it's a different kind of theater. It's it gives the audience, the illusion of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to give them reality. We're not trying to give them facts. We're trying to give them truth and the illusion of reality.
Now, as a director, what kind of preparation do you have to do with actors that you're working with to get that kind of illusion so that they can work within the structure and have it look improvised or improvise within that structure?
Well, they do all the work. They're the artists. I don't do much of anything. In fact, I do my very best to talk as little as possible to actors about what it is they're doing. I mean, I try to give them ideas, let them see what I give them options, but they have to come up with these characters. If I did any film, any piece of work I've ever done, if it all happened exactly as I wanted it to happen in my mind before, it'd be really terrible. But these people, these actors come in, they become these characters, and they fill out the whole life of them. And they bring things into me that I've never seen before or thought of or dreamed of. And I'm sitting here watching this unfold. It's like doing a mural where the pigment, the paint is living. So I put the green up on the canvas, and it has its own life, and it moves toward the yellow, and it moves away from the red, and all this. I put it in certain places, but it forms its own. The picture becomes that.
I think of you as being the opposite of a method actor's director.
I don't know what that is. A method act. I mean, that's an acting system, I guess, that many actors use that I deal with and many don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's the same thing, really. The actor's going into their own sense memories and sources to bring forth behavior and behavioral patterns.
Earlier when we were talking about television, you said that one of the things you wanted to do in your early television career was have overlapping dialogue, have two characters talking simultaneously, or three or four. Like what happens in an actual room of people where you're overhearing several conversations at the same time. It's another thing that you've become very well known for in the film industry. Did you feel when you started directing that it was very stilted to have one person saying their lines and then pausing and then the other person saying their lines?
Well, and I think in most cases it is. But, you know, I saw the early films of Howard Hawks and people like that, and overlapping dialogue was used all the time. A lot of screenwriters don't like it because they have this planned in a certain way, but they're wrong in some cases. And I've done whole films where people, there's not an overlap line in it because that's the way the behavior would be. But in most cases, I don't think people listen to other people. I mean, as soon as they start talking, the other person knows what they're going to say, and they're thinking of their response right away. And we try to get that. I just try to have that same feeling, so an audience gets a feeling, not anything specific.
Have you had to figure out how much the ear can follow?
Well, you can't. You can sit in a restaurant because you have two ears, and you can actually, your brain can direct, you can isolate, you can actually zoom in, iris in on a table and close out other voices. You can do that. It's very hard to do that on in the film are we have the same dimension. We have two dimensions on what you see in film and television, and your hearing's the same way. So again, we have to give the illusion of you being able to make that selection. You can't actually make it. In a stereo situation, it's possible for you to do it. But with your eyes glued on one object, it's difficult. So again, we have to do a little, it's the illusion of it.
Robert Altman is my guest, and he's now directing the Tanner 88 series for HBO, and he's directed many movies, including MASH and Nashville and Fool for Love. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you gave Cher, Lily Tomlin, and Robin Williams their first acting roles.
Well, not their first acting roles.
The first film roles. The first film roles.
Well, if they've done something else, in each case, I never had any questions, or it never entered my mind that they couldn't, they wouldn't be just wonderful. They're the ones that, again, have to do the work. And Cher, when I ran into her, and she said, "I want to be a serious actress." And I said, "Well, good, come and be serious. I've got a play. You want to read for it?" And she said, "Yes." And so I put her in the play.
You had a period of a few years where none of your films were really making it commercially. Films like Health and Quintet, A Wedding, even Fool for Love, which I think got a lot of critical praise, never really made it commercially. Do you want to go back into movies now, or do you feel like you've...
Well, I don't... That's all marketing. You mean they didn't suit the market. Those films were, to me... highly successful films.
Mm-hmm.
A Wedding is one of the Quintet. Those are all. I mean, I have very few films that that we didn't achieve what we set out to do. If we didn't achieve what the people who sell them set out to do, that really is their problem. The problem with making films now, I've got lots of films I'd like to make, but I don't think anybody's going to give me the money to make them, because I don't think I can or will make the films that they want to make that serve this existing market. You make a film now, it has to go, the movie houses are, the cinemas are very hard to get into. Look at Bertolucci's film, The Last Emperor, won 9 Academy Awards, and it can't get a decent theater in any city in the country, because they're all playing... Beetlejuice and Fatal Jump Jump or whatever the, you know, all this trash is. It seems to me that art is something that you should do, and people should come and find its way to it. And you can't, what audiences really want to see is something they've never seen before. And these people now are marketing, of course, just reruns of stuff they have seen. So movies don't really interest me right now.
So for the time being, you feel you have more freedom in television and cable?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for the fresh air.
My guest has been film director Robert Altman, and he's currently directing Tanner 88. HBO will present a 3-hour block of all the Tanner segments that have already been produced on Saturday, June 4th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with actor and comic Howie Mandel. He plays Dr. Wayne Fiscus on TV's Saint Elsewhere, which is about to broadcast its last episode. I hope you can join us.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Novelist William Boyd says that you can live through the most important events of the century and fail to comprehend their meaning. In his new novel, he puts his main character to the test by having him witness two world wars and the birth of the film industry. Coming up, we talk with William Boyd. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Funkadelic, the black group that started out singing doo-wop and ended up playing acid rock. And John Leonard reviews Dreamtime, Jeffrey O'Brien's semi-autobiographical view of the 1960s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. President Reagan fulfilled his promise to veto the omnibus trade bill today, and the House immediately voted to override. More from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
President Reagan's chief objection to the trade bill came over a provision requiring certain employers to give 60 days' notice before closing down a plant. Though the president sought to expand his criticisms of the bill in his veto message today, debate on the House floor focused on the plant closings issue. Democrats look at polls showing that 85% of the people support the idea of notification and see a political plum for the November election. To avoid giving the Democrats that issue, 60 Republicans voted with them, despite the plea from Republican leaders to sustain the president's veto and send him a new trade bill without the plant closings provision. The Senate is likely to uphold the president when it votes on the trade bill veto. That action's not planned until after the Moscow summit. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Senate leaders of both parties today took steps to gain approval of the INF Treaty before President Reagan meets with Soviet leader Gorbachev next week. A small group of conservative senators has delayed ratification of the agreement by introducing a number of amendments. Majority Leader Robert Byrd and Minority Leader Robert Dole filed a petition that would lead to the end of the filibuster. Byrd said today the cloture petition could be approved by Thursday.
It's conceivable that we could finish the work on the treaty by Friday. Or Saturday. I would certainly say that the chances are pretty good. There's no reason why we should have continued delay for the sake of delay.
President Reagan says he's happy that Senate leaders are moving to cut off debate on the treaty. White House Chief of Staff Howard Baco will stay in Washington after the president leaves for Moscow tomorrow to carry the treaty to the Kremlin if it's ratified. Fighting near the Afghan capital of Kabul has slowed the Soviet military withdrawal from that country. Radio Kabul said two people were killed today in guerrilla rocket attacks on the capital. Anti-government rebels have also stepped up pressure in southern Afghanistan. Western diplomats say they doubt the Soviets can live up to a promise to pull one quarter of their forces out by the time General Secretary Gorbachev and President Reagan meet on Sunday. But diplomats say the Soviet high command would have half of its forces out of Afghanistan by mid-August, as required under an international pact signed in Geneva last month. The Supreme Soviet today dropped fired Moscow Party chief Boris Yeltsin from the top rung of the nation's parliament. He was voted out of the Supreme Soviet Presidium by a unanimous vote. He was dismissed as head of the Moscow Party last year in a dispute with General Secretary Gorbachev. Yeltsin had argued for a faster pace of reform and charged that Gorbachev's policies were not benefiting the Soviet public. U.S. Customs agents say they found 15 tons of hashish and 30 tons of marijuana on board a barge in San Francisco Bay early today. The stash was discovered as the boat and tug passed under the Golden Gate Bridge. Five men have been arrested. Officials believe it may be the biggest combination seizure in U.S. history. Orders for durable goods rose in April for the third consecutive month. The 0.8% increase came on the strength of orders for military communications equipment and electrical machinery. Data resources economist Roger Brinner says the report from the Commerce Department shows businesses haven't followed the pattern of consumer spending.
It's another sign that businesses have ignored the stock market crash. Consumers at first reacted, slowing down their purchases, but then they came back pretty nicely in the opening months of 1988. Businesses never paid any attention to it, apparently, and have continued to order quite strongly.
Economists say the rise in orders was slightly higher than expected and indicates continued economic growth. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 21 points to close at 1962.53. Advances led declines. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of the Funkadelics, a band whose blend of psychedelia and Motown was, in the words of their leader George Clinton, like the Temptations on acid.
It was one of the great rock bands of the 70s, propelled by some stinging guitars, some amazing songs, and a stage show like nothing anybody had ever seen before. But the chances are, no matter how big a rock and roll fan you are, that you never got to see, let alone hear, Funkadelic. Funkadelic actually started in the 50s, in a New Jersey barbershop where the barbers straightened black people's hair and sold pot out the back door. During slow times, some of the barbers would sing, and soon they had a doo-wop group, which they called the Parliaments, who were led by an energetic young man named George Clinton. They played around northern New Jersey until they heard about Motown, whereupon they loaded everything they had into a van and drove to Detroit. Camping out on Motown's front lawn and serenading anybody who walked up the path didn't get them anywhere, at least not with Motown, but they did eventually get signed to a small record label and release a few records, including I Wanna Testify, which became a good-sized hit in 1967. When the label went broke soon afterwards, it still owned the name The Parliaments, and the band was stuck. But not for long. Clinton had been paying as much attention to the rock and roll scene in Detroit, the MC5, the Stooges, the Amboy Dukes, as he had to Motown, and he had an idea. Why not a black psychedelic band? And Funkadelic was born. Their ace in the hole was guitarist Eddie Hazel. Solo, Maggot Brain, which we've just heard part of, was taken on by some brave radio stations. But the bad news was that Funkadelic was arriving on the scene just as so-called progressive radio was purging all black music from its playlist. It didn't matter that Maggot Brain, despite its title, was a tender and expressive bit of virtuosity. One Jimi Hendrix was enough, and the one they had was safely dead. But being an outlaw was nothing new for Funkadelic, and George even wrote a song about people's problems accepting the band called Standing on the Verge of Getting It On.
Get it if you don't dig it. Don't mean it's not the thing, a thing to do. Could be just for you. Even if you don't feel it. Right now don't mean someday it'll turn you out. You'll be out of sight. You really shouldn't ought to fight it. The music is designed to do no harm. It's just for you. With just a little bit of effort, I can't even whip, we might just turn you on.
If the band was going to be underground, so be it. They'd make money by reviving the Parliaments, this time just called Parliament, and save Funkadelic for fun. Band members came and went, and Eddie Hazel even did some serious time in prison after biting a flight attendant. Clinton recruited a 16-year-old kid from Cleveland, Mike Hampton, to pinch hit, and he turned out to be a true wizard. By this time, Parliament was having huge hits on Casablanca Records, so Clinton got Funkadelic, who were essentially the same people, a deal with Warner Brothers, and there they recorded their masterpiece in 1978. Do you promise to phone? Parliament being one of the biggest acts in the nation, the vision of one nation under a groove seemed attainable, but Clinton had too many balls in the air and a bunch of them fell at once. He claims that Funkadelic will be back, and I know for a fact he's been recording at Prince's Paisley Park studio. But until then, there are a lot of wonderful Funkadelic albums out there, most of them with outrageous covers by Chicago artist Pedro Bell, just waiting for you to discover them. As Funkadelic once said, the music is designed to do no harm.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Chances are you haven't seen the movie Stars and Bars that William Boyd wrote, based on his novel of the same name, although the film stars Daniel Day-Lewis, it's only opened in a few cities. Boyd has written a new novel about a film director obsessed with making an epic based on philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau's book, The Confessions. Boyd's novel, The New Confessions, takes the autobiographical form of Rousseau's book. It's the story of John James Todd, who was born in 1899. His life parallels the major historical events of the 20th century. Here's William Boyd reading a passage in which the character introduces himself.
Let me tell you something about this enterprise upon which we have both, you and I, embarked. Here is a story of a life, my life, one man's life in the 20th century. This is what I have done, and this is what has been done to me. If on occasion I have used some innocent embellishment, it has been only to fill the odd defect of memory. Sometimes I may have taken for a fact what was no more than a probability. But, and this is crucial, I have never put down as true what I knew to be false. I present myself as I was, vile and contemptible when I behaved in that fashion, and kind, generous, and selfless when I was so. I have always looked closely at those around me, and have not spared myself that same scrutiny. I am not a cynic. I am not prejudiced. I am simply a realist. I do not judge, I note. So, here I am. You may groan at my unbelievable blunders, berate me for my numberless imbecilities, and blush to the whites of your eyes at my confessions, but can you, I wonder, can you really put your hand on your heart and say, I am better than he?
Your book, The New Confessions, is, in a way, an homage to Rousseau's Confessions.
Yeah.
And your character is trying to film, the main character in your book is trying to film Rousseau's book. Why is that book important to you, as I imagine it must be?
Well, it had a similar effect on me as it does on my character, in that I was studying the literature of the early 19th century, and in the course of this kept getting a lot of references to The Confessions by Rousseau, this scandalous book that had shocked Europe. And I turned to it out of a sense of duty, but I, in fact, had an amazingly pleasant read. It's a fantastic book. It's completely modern and candid in tone. And to think it was written in the middle of the 18th century is quite astonishing. So it was like a great breath of fresh air blowing through the sort of dusty scholarly studies that I was engaged on at the time. And I got very caught up in the character of Rousseau, a kind of self-destructive, genial egomaniac who's paranoid and neurotic, but at the same time an astonishing talent and rather remarkable human being. And I just thought, I wonder what he'd be doing if he was alive today. And that was the beginning of the novel. So my character is a sort of debased, slightly vulgarized Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
The main character in your book lists through some of the great events of the century, both world wars, the transition in movies from sound films, from silent films to sound films. But somehow living through all these great events doesn't really ennoble him and make him wise?
No, I think, this is my own feeling, I feel that you can participate in great historical moments, but for most people, they pass them, history kind of passes you by. You're actually more preoccupied in earning a living or falling in and out of love or something like that, and you don't realize the momentous times you're living in. And so I wanted to look at one man's life in the 20th century, as I say, and put him down in certain key places. For example, he's in Berlin during the rise of the Nazis, but he's not really bothered about the Nazis. He thinks they're slightly odd, eccentric people. And my own impression from doing the research and reading ordinary lives or accounts of ordinary lives during these events is that most of their significance is derived from hindsight, and you, at the time, you don't really know that you're living through something momentous.
Now, what about you? Do you think of yourself as having been shaped by the momentous events that you have lived through, or do you think that you have just not paid that much attention to them and not been that shaped by them?
I don't think I've been that shaped. I mean, maybe if, when I'm in my 70s, I'll look back and see some sort of pattern. But I think life's a much more random, chaotic business than we would normally think. The one event I was shaped by was living in Africa, in Nigeria, during the Biafran War, which was a particularly bloody civil war. And I was kind of on the fringes of that. And that did have a big effect on me, and it did change the way I thought about a lot of things. But at the time, I was 17 or 18, and it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that it began to sink in. So even there, when it seemed like, you know, history was kind of boiling up all around me, or African history was, I was kind of passing through it as a fairly callow, unobservant teenager, but it did buffet me around a bit.
Was it finally more terrifying to experience it than what you thought it would be like?
I think so. I think that all our kind of human endeavors to explain or evaluate end up by putting a kind of shape and form on experience. And my own intuition is that experience is much more random and uncontrolled than we like to think. I think we all pretend that the sun's going to rise the next day, but you can't know anything for sure. And I saw in Nigeria during those years at the end of the 60s just how crazy and messed up life could be. And that's why again and again I come back to writing about war in my books, because I think it's a very handy metaphor for the conditions that we all live under, even in comparatively mundane and banal existences. It's not as under control as we like to think.
Well, you grew up in colonial Africa. What brought your parents to Africa? Why did they move there?
Well, my father was out there during the Second World War. He was an army doctor, and there were big convalescent bases in West Africa, and he served there. And then after the war, he got married, and he thought he would go out there for another couple of years because he'd enjoyed the life there. But he ended up staying for 30 years, and I was born and spent most of my infancy and early childhood out there as well.
How did you start writing?
I remember at about the age of 15 or 16, when I suppose one starts thinking, you know, what the hell am I going to do when I grow up, when I'm an adult? And I just remember thinking I would like to be an artist, or either an artist, or I was quite good at painting and drawing, and but I was also good at writing English essays and so on. So it was really just an idle ambition that I allowed to grow in me. I didn't do much about it, and I went to university to read English literature, and, you know, anybody who studies English literature at some point weighs up the fact of, you know, can I possibly do the same sort of thing as I'm studying? But it was there was no kind of blinding flash of light, and I wasn't a precocious student or anything like that. It was just a kind of hankering for the writer's life that allowed me to sort of drift into it in a way.
Your writing is for the most part comic, satirical. Do you ever try to write something serious and find out that it comes out funny?
Well, you're exactly right. In fact, I remember one of my unpublished novels. I started off to write a very grim, earnest work, and it turned into a sort of ironic, absurd comedy. And I think it just depends on the way you see the world, how you pitch your particular fiction. I'm not a sort of tragedian at all. I don't see the world as a sort of veil of tears, and my own approach to it determines inevitably, I think, that when I write about things, even tragic things or grim things, that there's always a kind of ironic or absurd twist to them. And it's not something that I've worked up. I think it's just inherent.
Well, does that irony and absurdity enter into the way you perceive tragic events in your own life?
With hindsight, perhaps. But, of course, at the time, I'm like anybody else.
Falling apart.
Yes, you know, yeah. Absolutely shattered. But distance, you know, lends any kind of event in your own life a different set of qualities. But it's when I'm dealing with my characters, I can be much more ruthless than I can with my own life. And I give my characters a tremendously hard time. But it's sort of in the interests of showing the sort of absurd, uncontrollable aspects of existence.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Not at all. It's a great pleasure.
William Boyd's new novel is called The New Confessions. You're listening to Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What you got for us?
Our top story today is that President Reagan vetoed the massive trade bill. Now, Terry, as you probably remember, that bill was a couple of years in the making. It had a cast of about 100 congressmen working on it. It now goes back to Capitol Hill, where there's an effort in the works already to override the veto, and we'll have a couple of reports on that tonight. Also, hunger in Vietnam. Vietnam is experiencing something of a famine, and the U.S. government has been getting pleas for help from the Vietnamese government, but so far they're saying no help. Also, we have tonight the sounds of Bulgarian art music.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Dreamtime is a new book about the 60s by poet and literary critic Jeffrey O'Brien. It's been described as a meditation on the decade, but book critic John Leonard says the author missed some vital moments.
According to Aboriginal myth, Dreamtime was when legendary totemic figures wandered the song lines of Australia on walkabouts, singing out the names of every bird and rock, summoning the world into being. Think of an entire continent as a musical score. According to Jeffrey O'Brien, Dreamtime was the American 60s, when another sort of totemic figure, stranger, hippie, child of the future, wandered a different kind of song map, naming states of mind, inventing the counterculture. O'Brien, whose articles and essays have appeared in the New York Review of Books and the Village Voice, takes a walkabout in his own past. In alternating chapters of autobiographical I, imperial we, and a sort of third-person semi-fiction, he is fearful, rhapsodic, liturgical, nostalgic. But that past is lost, like Atlantis. Think of an entire generation as a figment of its own imagination. To what exactly was this culture counter? According to O'Brien, it was counter to the bomb, which haunted suburbia, to big cities, that waste of metal and stone, to the CIA, and patriarchal grammar and illusory politics and pig mind control, to Christianity and centuries of self-hatred and sex-hatred and nature-hatred. That's a lot to counter. The new Aborigines sang their opposition into being out of Greenwich Village, Berkeley, and San Francisco, from science fiction, horror movies, Marvel comics, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, with rock music and borrowed mysticisms. But mostly they relied on sex and drugs. The drug was the text, says O'Brien, and the rest of their lives a commentary on it. Be a fast car, he says, and, quote, tough and slinky will weather the laser wars. Hitting our arms with needles is a way to get in shape for it, an Apache ritual gearing us up for the approaching massacres. And then there's the sadness. Somehow, because of cops and Calvinism and organized crime, bad dope and bad vibes, these Haight Ashbury and Lower East Side Indians went paranoid crazy. People got scared. They'd gone to a movie of the end of the world. Dreamtime is brilliant, rueful, fugue-like, in both the musical and psychiatric senses. It is also amazingly parochial and solipsistic. Imagine a book on the 60s that hardly mentions civil rights. A book in which the entire anti-war movement is reduced to a single march on Washington, as if it were just another movie. A book in which women are expected to stay home full of, quote, silent and passive mysteries to welcome back the bright and active male, Taoist, pilgrim hippie, as though feminism had never happened. When history and Richard Nixon came down hard on the counterculture in 1968, where were these guys, these needle-happy Apaches? They seemed to have nodded off when the heat was on.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, and as a columnist for New York Newsday, he reviewed Dreamtime by Jeffrey O'Brien. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with China watcher Orville Schell. His new book, Discos and Democracies, examines China's continuing love-hate relationship with the West. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the work of little-known French soprano René Doria. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will look at how radical politics and New Age thought mix in the language of Berkeley, California. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.